You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting on KPCW, Park City, Utah. Good morning. You are listening to KPCW. My name is Allison Kulo, and this is KPCW's Mountain Money. We are waiting for our host, Doug Wells, to join us, obviously. We are excited to have him as our host today as well. I want to tell you a bit about who we have going on for our guests this morning. This morning, we've got Tyler Maroney. He's joining us to talk about his new book, The Modern Detective, How Corporate Intelligence is Reshaping the World. Second is on September 15th, 2020, the new SLC opened. It's the first new hub airport built in the U.S. in the 21st century. Nancy Vollmer, Director of Communications and Marketing for the new SLC, will join Mountain Money to talk about the new facility. And Barish Dawson will join us to talk about STEM Elevated, a STEM, which is Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Interactive Learning Lab that is brand new to small business in Park City. And it looks like Doug's on. Doug, good morning.
Good morning. Great to join you, Allison. We're going to have a great show today, and we're looking forward to the discussion, particularly our first discussion with the private detective. As somebody growing up reading Encyclopedia Brown books and watching Columbo on TV, I'm very excited to hear what our author has to say. And you're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Mountain Money. On air with us now, we have the author of the book, The Modern Detective. Tyler Maroney is joining us by phone. Good morning, Tyler.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Tyler, everyone is fascinated with the archetype of the rogue detective, but the modern detective operates with a mix of the traditional and cutting edge. Talk to us a bit about private investigators and how they've evolved to the 21st century private eye.
So part of the purpose of writing the book was to make the point that I think private eyes get a bad rap. And that's mostly due to the fact that when news reporters write about us, they write about some of the nefarious things that the worst of us in our industry do. But also I think that we're influenced, not always in a bad way, by the fictional private detective. And you know, who we learned about, whether reading Encyclopedia Brown or novels by Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. But the modern detective is nothing like any of those characters. I mean, we are professionals who come out of law and accounting and investigative journalism, you know, and work in many of the same ways in a profession that is using technology in very smart ways and working to help clients improve their businesses or solve a mystery, as opposed to do something that usually involves, you know, sitting in the bushes with a long lens. So it's an attempt to kind of reform the image of the private detective.
We're having difficulty hearing Doug right now. So want to go to our second question, which is, you know, from internet trolls to false advertising, private investigators help unmask who is speaking truly fake news online. Can you shed some light on these types of tactics?
Sure. So in many ways, the private detective is not the fedora-wearing, gun-slinging stereotype, but in fact is someone who is technologically savvy, who understands where information lives online, for instance. And in much the ways that businesses themselves need to be innovative when it comes to technology, so do private detectives, in the same way that lawyers and accountants might have to. And that might involve understanding where you can identify, say, news that is false, disinformation online, for instance, or it's understanding how to unmask somebody who is posting something on social media anonymously. And it's understanding how to find that kind of information, where it lives, and then how to advise your clients what to do with it.
And then, you know, given the recent news of election interference from Iran and Russia, what types of clues do investigators or what types of clues may they have found in identifying the culprits of the Proud Boys email?
Well, I couldn't speak to that specific example, but the question is a great one when it comes to looking for, you know, the role that private detectives play in helping us understand whether narratives that we read online, on social media, and in the news are true, and whether not just that the stories are true, but that the journalists themselves are real people. And I'll give just a quick example.
I can hear Alice.
We once worked on a case involving the spread of information around a political candidate. And it turns out that information was not only generated by someone you would not expect, but in fact was generated by bots. In other words, generated by a computer algorithm, which was quite literally writing these stories online through a computer program and not through any nefarious acts of a person. So it's being able to identify that kind of narrative and that kind of information and figure out where it comes from, which then can hopefully allow us to, you know, have more faith and more trust in our social media networks and in our news.
Thank you. I apologize. We're having some difficulties with our other guest, with Doug. So thank you for that. So I want to maybe move more towards, you know, corporate investigators and how they're used. So how often are corporate investigators used in business deals and legal battles?
So I appreciate the question, because the easy answer is that quite often, and I don't want this to worry anybody, because I think that the stereotype is that the use of private detectives is for, you know, something that is, you know, seen as shady, for instance, some kind of corporate espionage or surveillance. But the vast majority of the work that we do is helping businesses do their routine businesses. And that might include everything from a background check on a prospective employee to helping a company kick the tires on a vendor that it might want to acquire, to helping a company collect facts for its lawyers when the company is involved in some kind of litigation, say over an intellectual property dispute or a contract dispute with an employee. And my point there is that the work that the private detective plays, gathering information, collecting facts, is in many ways very routine. In that we are helping find information, turning it into intelligence, and then giving it to our clients so that they can make smart decisions to help their business grow and be more profitable.
So Tyler, you talk about how the modern detective is, you know, not like the figure that I have in mind in the past. They're highly skilled. They're very, very good at what they do. In your case, Tyler, you were a Fulbright scholar. You worked as a journalist. I'm assuming it was an investigative journalist, and your work appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Fortune, Frontline. The list goes on and on. How did you get attracted to this business? It seems like being an investigative journalist is the highest societal benefit for somebody with your skill sets. And people have mixed feelings about detective work. You know, we're talking about examples now of people finding out, you know, that somebody was embezzling money from them, or maybe there's an employee whose background's not what they say it is. That's all stuff that people have a feel good about. There's also kind of an underside of this business where maybe you're doing investigative work on for a divorce, or there's a business dispute between partners and they're trying to find dirt on one another. What was it about this business that attracted you away from investigative journalism and to do private detective work?
So I was a journalist for about 10 years, and the last year or so of that was as an investigative journalist, and which meant to me finding hidden information, revealing something that the public didn't know about, that in many cases would show wrongdoing either by a company or by an elected official, or even by, you know, someone who works in the supermarket. It doesn't have to be, you know, national news level information. And by chance, I met somebody at a large investigative firm called Kroll, where I took my first job. And I quickly discovered that people often transition from investigative journalism to this kind of work. So you're exactly right about that. And yes, I acknowledge that there are people in my industry who cross the line. And part of the purpose of my book was to say that this is not how the vast majority of us operate, and that it's kind of unfortunate that the media will cover the worst of us and not the best of us. So I wanted to make an effort to kind of show and highlight the work of the quite literally tens of thousands of men and women in this profession who take it very seriously. Now, I'll say one thing. Outside of the United States, there are no barriers to entry at all. You are often simply a private detective because you declare yourself to be one. Where in the United States, there is a regulatory regime. You are licensed to be a private detective, which one hopes means that there are a certain sense of professional perspectives and laws that private eyes need to follow. And I take that very seriously, and so does everyone that I work with.
So Tyler, let's just dig into that a little bit more. In many professional organizations that require a designation, there's probably a fair amount of study that goes into it. There's an examination, and then there's ongoing education. And oftentimes for attorneys, accountants, financial advisors, the one required subject every year is ethics. There's a whole bunch of different subjects that you can get continuing education on, keep your license current. I'm assuming it's the same with private detectives. Talk to us about what the ethical standards are in your industry. What are the standards that, as an organization, your group is trying to uphold?
So I really appreciate that question because it goes to the heart of one of the themes of the book. Each state regulates the profession slightly differently, but absolutely, there is almost always a requirement that private detectives act ethically in the same way that there are requirements that lawyers act ethically. And one of the biggest no-nos is what's called often pretexting, which means using one identity, often a false identity, or a little white lie to identify yourself and explain to the person you're interviewing in slightly inaccurate terms why you're calling. And the reason that I think that this is horrible is that it not only it involves deception, but it puts not just the private detective at risk, but the witness at risk, and ultimately the client at risk. And one of the reasons, to go back to your question about journalism, that I think that journalists are often good private detective is that journalists know how to identify themselves by name and by affiliation in the way that any ethical person would. And I have done that my entire career, and it's never been an issue because I worry that sometimes private detectives think that without deception, they cannot crack the case. And that is simply not accurate.
So take us inside. How do you tell somebody I'm Tyler, I'm a private investigator, and I'd like to ask you some questions, and how do you get them to tell you the dirt that you need to know?
Well, one answer is that it's usually not dirt, it's usually information. And I'll give you an example. We often are asked by a company that is in some kind of a lawsuit with a competitor over some issue. Like, let's say a CFO left one company and joined another one, and the former employer worries the CFO has been stealing trade secrets or trying to poach employees. And so one of the things we'll do is we will call former employees of the new company, of the new employer, and simply ask them what they know about the CFO and identify ourselves by name. And the employees that we'll try to call first are employees who might have left because they were dissatisfied with their employer, which means that they may have a motive to talk to us and often be, you know, more honest about what they feel about their former employer. And that's a scenario where it doesn't pay to make up who you are and why you're calling. And one of the things I learned quickly when I left journalism is that people like to talk and they like to tell stories. And if people are uncomfortable with talking to me, then I understand that, because we don't have any legal way to compel anyone to speak. We simply hope that they can. And that's why we go through the front door, so to speak, with honesty and transparency.
When I think of old detective movies, or when the people are being questioned, and I take that and put it on top of the example you gave with regards to calling former employees to find out about a prospective new employee, you always look at, you know, what are the signs? Are they looking up? Are they looking down to the left? They're shuffling their papers. You know, when you're doing this all via phone, what tells, or how can you tell if the person is being truthful, or perhaps they were just hoping to be vindictive?
Great question. And here's my first response is that I don't believe anything that you just said. In other words, I'm not saying that you were wrong. I'm saying that there is a misperception that because somebody is sweating or looking away, that they are therefore lying. That is simply not true. And if you look at the science around interview techniques that police detectives use, it simply proves that that's not true. So I just want to warn everyone that's mostly fictional when they see that, because how do you really know? It's essentially a guess. And essentially, there's no evidence or facts or science that support that. It makes for good television, for sure. And certainly, maybe it's something that as an interviewer you can think about as you conduct an interview. But I would caution that no one should draw a firm conclusion about someone's motives based on their body language. The second thing is that, you know, unfortunately, during this coronavirus pandemic, we are all at home all the time. Which at first made us as private detectives worry that we wouldn't be able to talk to anybody. But it turns out that because we're all home so much, we find that people actually are more willing to talk in some cases than they were previously, because, we are getting restless. And one of the techniques we've been using is to not just call people, but ask them if they'd be willing to FaceTime or do a Zoom call or some kind of video that allows us to introduce ourselves, so the people we're speaking to can see who we are and see that we are being transparent in who we are. And that often can turn into a really interesting conversation.
So Tyler, let's talk about that, because I think this is a business show, and one of the secrets in business is getting people to want to help you, which you're in the business, of gathering information from others. So ultimately, you have to have people that want to help you. What are some truths that you have found through your career that you could share with our audience when you're talking to somebody for the first time? You know, maybe you don't have a 10-year relationship with them. You're going to speak to them once or twice. What are some things that you do that make people want to help you?
So I think my first answer to that question, which I really do appreciate, is that you have to do your homework as a private detective. And by that, I mean you have to understand the world in which you're operating. So, in my book, for instance, I have 10 chapters, and they're, hopefully compelling, fast-paced, stories. But, at their core, they are about the business world. They are about bankruptcy trustees and private equity firms and hedge funds and real estate investment and retail. And in each case, if I'm going to make a phone call to somebody, in the real estate market, say someone who's an investor, I need to understand that market. I need to prove to anyone I'm speaking to that I understand the players, that I understand the dynamics, that I could explain the details of what a loan document is, and I understand, if it's a publicly traded company, about securities law. And I think that is a very valuable point, whether you're a private detective, a journalist, a lawyer, or an accountant, that you're not just so focused on your own tactics and your own identity, but on the subject matter that you're investigating.
So I know that a lot of times private investigators can work on problems the authorities either cannot or will not touch. Can you give us an example of this, maybe a scenario that you've gone through?
Sure. I would say the most common example is what we call internal investigations, when a company suspects that there is some kind of wrongdoing by its own employees. So, for instance, expense account fraud or vendor fraud. These are two of the most common kinds of fraud. And in that case, let's say you are the CEO of a small company and you worry that one of your employees is submitting receipts for expenses that are not connected to the business, that are personal. But your company is just big enough to not have the resources, because you're too busy, to look into this yourself. If it's not an actual crime or you don't suspect that it's a crime, you might bring in a private investigative firm to do this research for you, because we would be able to determine if this is just a rumor or if, in fact, there is some kind of possible criminal exposure here. And once that investigation is done, if, in fact, there was some crime or some fraud being carried out, we could then help refer it to law enforcement. But if there's not, then the conclusion is that it was either a spurious rumor or it simply was unethical, but maybe not criminal. So that's a situation where calling the FBI or calling the police may not be warranted quite yet until you get all the facts.
So, Tyler, having your skill set is very valuable, and it's a blessing, but I suspect it's also a curse, right? You know how to get answers to your most pressing questions, but there are times where maybe we shouldn't know the answers to our pressing questions. Maybe our life is better if we don't know the answer to certain things. Talk to me about when maybe you're talking to a client and you might think, you know what, you, Mr. Client, or better, Mr. or Mrs. Client, are better served not doing this investigation.
That's a great question. There are many situations where we turn down a case because we truly don't think that there is a there based on our scoping and preliminary analysis. There are also situations where we've done the beginning of an investigation and have found no leads or no evidence. And our advice is often that this is not worth pursuing further. Your question about sometimes we don't need to know is one that I completely agree with. I will say, however, that, since we are not journalists, we are hired by clients who are paying us to do this work. We are working at the direction of our clients and often at the direction of their lawyers. If there's some kind of legal dispute, for instance, or controversy. And there is often a disconnect between the ultimate client, so say the company itself, and the company's legal team, because sometimes a company just wants to find out the answer to a question, whereas the lawyers have discovered that there is no legal case here. So we are sometimes caught in between the motives of the company and the legal strategy of the lawyers. And my advice there is to have a conversation among all those stakeholders and to give your best advice as to whether an investigation is truly warranted.
Well, great, Tyler. We've really enjoyed our conversation with you this morning. Our guest has been Tyler Maroney. He is the author of The Modern Detective: How Corporate Intelligence is Reshaping the World. Tyler, thank you for joining us, and please stay tuned. Mountain Money will be back in a moment.
Welcome back to KPCW's Mountain Money. Up until September, Salt Lake City International Airport served more than 26 million passengers from facilities that were designed 50 years ago, which were intended to serve half as many travelers. On September 15, 2020, the new SLC opened, the first new hub airport built in the U.S. in the 21st century. What will travelers remember about the new SLC? From awe-inspiring art installations like the Canyon in the Falls and the Delta Sky Club's outdoor deck with its beautiful mountain views, to the electric plug-ins at each seat in the gate waiting areas, to the electric roster of eclectic roster of high-end shops and restaurants with street pricing, there's plenty to be impressed with within the new SLC. Joining us to talk this morning about it is Nancy Vollmer, Director of Communications and Marketing at the Salt Lake City International Airport. Nancy, thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. I love talking about the new SLC, so I appreciate it.
Well, I haven't had the opportunity, and I'm afraid perhaps many of our guests have not had the opportunity to talk about, or at least, pardon me, see the new airport. So we're excited to kind of get the description from you today. So from my understanding,
absolutely,
construction began in the summer of 2014. And last year, on September 12th, you were on ABC News quoting saying that the countdown is on and that just in over a year, the airport was going to open. And it opened exactly 1 year later. How did a project of this size stay on time despite being faced with an earthquake and pandemic this year?
I think I have to credit the team working on the project who really stayed focused on our deadline of September 15th. And we also put measures in place to ensure workers stayed safe. So when everyone realized the serious nature of the pandemic and we knew what it took to prevent it, we took necessary precautions to make sure that everyone stayed healthy on the project. So, for example, anyone who was entering the construction site was required to have their temperature taken. They were also required to wear a face covering and then to practice physical distancing. So that, I think, really helped everyone to stay healthy as much as possible and to stay focused on the project and to meet our deadlines.
So, Nancy, what can people expect to see when they're at the airport? I know it's coming in phases. So when people go to the airport, not everything is new yet. Talk about what is new and what might still be what we're used to seeing, and when will that be changed?
Actually, that's changing tomorrow. So on September 15th, we opened up a brand new parking garage with twice as many parking spaces. We opened up one central terminal. So before we had Terminal 1, 2, and the International Terminal. Now everyone goes to one place to check in, go through security screening. And then we opened up the west end of Concourse A, which is all of Delta's gates. So in between September 15th and October 27th, we have been using some of the existing concourses in the old facility, so Concourse C and what was A and B. We now call it F and G. So it's been a bit of a hike for passengers going through a new security checkpoint and then walking over to those old concourses.
Knowing that even the arrival when you get to the airport for a flight now looks different, should people give some extra time to navigate, or is that not a concern at this moment?
Oh, they absolutely should. This is a larger airport, so it's going to take more time to navigate. And a lot of people think, you know, we've done renovations or we've just expanded, but it is a totally new facility. So our passengers coming into the airport are going to be on a new roadway. We have an elevated roadway for passenger drop-off, and we also have a larger parking garage, so it will take time to figure out how to get from there to the terminal through security screening and onto your gate. So tomorrow when we open up Concourse B, there is a tunnel that was built actually in 2004 in preparation for this project, which gives you an idea of how long we've been planning this for. So the passengers will take a tunnel over to Concourse B, so that will take some extra time. If a passenger was used to going to Terminal 1, going through security checkpoint there, going up to their flights in what was Concourse A, it was much shorter than it will be now.
So, Nancy, you mentioned that this project has been planned since 2004. I've been doing this radio show for about 10 years now. And when I first started doing the show, we had somebody in that was talking about this project 10 years ago, 8 years ago. And they mentioned that no taxpayer dollars were going to be spent. This is a huge, huge project in the billions of dollars. What was the original budget? What did it end up being? And explain to our listeners how that got paid for.
Sure. So actually, we have been planning this since the late 1990s. It was put on hold just because we had 9/11, the Great Recession. There were some airlines who declared bankruptcy, so the project got a little bit late of a start. The good news about that was that we were able to continue saving money to start the project. So When this project started, we were the only large hub airport with no debt, which was unheard of in the U.S. So we were able to get started with the project with airport savings. Now, the airport is a department of the city, and we are considered what's called an enterprise fund. So we're responsible for all of our budget and whatever we spend, we have to generate that money. So, again, no local taxpayer dollars is the good news, but basically we'd like to say that the people who use the airport pay for it, whether that's the concessions, our tenants, meaning the airlines, whether it's a passenger. When you travel, you pay a fee on your ticket. When you rent a car, you're paying a fee. And so that's how we primarily pay for this project. Now, we are in debt now. We had to go out to the bond market and get some airport revenue bonds. And so we are paying for it through savings, passenger facility charges, car rental facility charges, and also the bond market.
And as you've mentioned, you know, there are a few funding options that are driven by airport use. And now with the pandemic, I can see both, you know, passenger travel has reduced as well as car rental. How are you forecasting the ability to pay for not just then the bond, but for the future improvements?
So we are very fortunate that when we started this project, our executive director of the time, who was Maureen Riley, and actually she was a resident of Park City, she was a CPA, and she was very savvy financially. So we had some good savings in place, and we have continued to have savings, so at least we can, you know, continue through these kind of rougher times here. So the project, just to go back to the total cost of it, it's $4.1 billion. And initially, the price tag was smaller, but that was because we have changed the scope on the project. So initially, we weren't planning to open Concourse B until down the road, but it just made sense. You know, you have all of the construction teams out here. We thought, well, let's, rather than continuing to use existing concourses, let's just start building Concourse B now. And I'm very glad that we did that because I think it provides a better passenger experience. But we are very focused on our budget. We're starting that process now. And we have seen a dramatic drop in our passenger travel. So, for example, earlier this year during the ski season, we had record-breaking numbers of about 30,000 people coming to the front door. Right now we're averaging about 10,000 people. So, but believe it or not, we're doing better than a lot of other airports nationally, and Delta has said that we're one of their better-performing hubs right now. And I think that's likely due to the fact that people are seeking outdoor experiences, right? They're wanting to visit national and state parks, and hopefully that will continue with the ski season.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad to hear that our airport is performing as well as others, and it sounds like even better. Which brings up an interesting question, Nancy. Who is your customer? Who is Delta your customer? Are the citizens of Salt Lake City your customers?
All of the above, because we have, of course, in addition to Delta, we have other airlines that are serving the airport. You know, we also have TSA. We have a number of concessions. We have the Customs and Border Protection, plus our passengers. So, you know, and also we try to be a very good neighbor. So we're very aware of the impact that we can have on the community and try to be good citizens in operating here.
Well, here's why I asked the question. I moved here 20 years ago from Denver. And one of the pleasant surprises when I moved to Salt Lake was just how reasonable the airfare was compared to Denver, because Denver was pretty expensive. It's very reasonable here, and it's kind of swapped now. Denver has very much more, I think, lower rates than we do, and it's not really relevant in today's world, right? We're all kind of hunkering down and dealing with this pandemic. But how do we balance out the needs, you know, for competition to keep the rates low versus being able to serve, you know, Delta is obviously a very important client for the Salt Lake City Airport. Is that something that you guys consider, or is that not on your radar screen?
It is. It's something that, it's something that the airlines pay a fee, and we actually charge one of the lower fees nationwide. And even with this new airport, we've been trying to keep that rate low. But to your point of the fees that passengers pay for airline tickets, you know, it depends on the competition. And up until opening this new airport, we were at capacity when it came to gate space. So the airport was not out actively recruiting new air service. When you do get new air service in, whether it's another airline like Spirit or international airline like Condor, they provide competition. And so that will impact what the passenger pays for a ticket. Our hope is that once the travel industry starts to recover and people start traveling more, that we'll be able to go out and recruit new air service, possibly some new airlines, and that will provide a better variety for people traveling through SLC.
That's important information that I did not know about, so thank you for explaining that. I want to get back to the new airport, and I know that the renovations helped with operations and efficiencies. Can you let us know what will passengers perhaps not see but experience?
Well, I don't think a lot of people realize now that the airport's previous configuration was not very efficient. It was a pier configuration, kind of like your fingers. So basically, there was only one aircraft that could go in between those piers at one time. So let's say that your flight arrived early. So that was the good news. But then you couldn't get to a gate. So that was the bad news. With this new linear configuration, it's much more efficient because multiple aircraft can move in and out of the gate areas at one time. The airlines like it because they can get on the ground, they can unload their passengers, load their new passengers, and get back in the air. And the passengers like it because they won't be waiting on the tarmac for a gate.
Nancy, I'm fortunate to work with a very articulate and intelligent producer and co-host. Allison, I think, asked you a great question, which is, what don't we see? And talk to us about that.
Right.
Let me take the opposite side of that coin. I know a lot of thought was put into the visual appeal of the airport, and investments were made. Talk to us about that. What is some of the visual eye candy that we can look forward to when we all start traveling again?
It is a beautiful airport. And early on in this project, when we were designing how this airport would look, we went out to the local community and we said, what do you want to see in your new airport? And overwhelmingly, people said they wanted to see the beauty of Utah represented in the facility. And so we took that to heart. And you'll see that in the colors, in the artwork. For example, the exterior of the airport is a copper color. When you enter the airport, you'll see some beautiful large-scale art installations that represent the canyons of Utah. We have the falls. It's a piece that is 65 feet from ceiling to floor. It's dichroic glass. It reflects the sunlight and creates different colors. The canyon is something that is lit and it goes on the spine of the terminal. It's a beautiful piece. And plus, we have art in the security checkpoint area. Each restroom has what's called a whimsy wall, and that's artwork by different local and national artists. Each restroom has a different piece of artwork. I'm really excited tomorrow to open up the Mid-Concourse Tunnel because we have the Four Seasons of Utah represented in that. We have a local artist by the name of Tracy O'Very Covey who did two of the seasons, and then an artist out of Texas, Doss, who did two other seasons. So it's a bit of a walk to go through the tunnel, but it's going to be a beautiful walk. So I think that people are going to be really taken back by seeing that artwork. When we opened up 6 weeks ago, people were just in awe of what they saw. And even every day when I come into work, I see passengers with their phones up taking selfies or just taking pictures of the canyon and the falls because it's just so beautiful.
And that's one of those pieces that I think you wanted or was one of the goals, is to be able to have passengers understand or get to know Utah a bit better. in the airport. You mentioned the Beauty in the Loo piece, which are those murals in the restrooms, but I have to say that there are additional restroom features that you've brought on board. Do you want to explain what you've done with regards to restrooms?
We like to joke that we had a bathroom committee of one who decided to have more than potty parity, and that was Maureen Riley, as I mentioned. She was our previous executive director, and it was a priority for her. She wanted to make sure that there were plenty of restrooms, because what's the first thing that you do before you go on a flight and the first thing you do when you land? And so you're never more than 150 feet away from the next restroom facility. And also, the restrooms are designed so there's two different sides. So if one side is being cleaned, there's still the other side is open for passengers to use. Each of the women's restrooms has a lactation room. Both men's and women's restrooms have changing tables. The doors are longer, and they lock to indicate if it's occupied or not. For our animal friends, we actually have indoor pet relief areas now, too, which will be a really nice feature for people who are traveling with their dogs.
And the one piece for me that I wanted to, that I had seen too, is the restrooms are deeper. And I know when traveling with young children, you know, oftentimes there's not a lot of room left. And so you seek out the ADA restrooms, but now with them being 2 feet deeper, it gives us a bit more space.
Absolutely. And even if you don't have children, if you're just can pull your luggage in, which is so much more convenient than it was previously.
Great. Well, Nancy, we're almost out of time, but quickly, I know a project like this that's 20 years in the making. You mentioned the planning started in the 1990s. Takes a lot of people to make happen. Politically, though, give us two or three people that you would like to thank for their vision 20 years ago that gave us what we have today.
Oh, gosh. Just three people, huh? you know, there's so many people who were involved with this project early on. In addition to the executive directors here at the airport, just our construction team had Mike Williams. He is an amazing person to have on board. I can never understand how he can keep all the information he can in his brain, but he has kept this project on track. You know, we've had a number of mayors here, too, that have been involved with this project. And so, you know, city council has been involved with it. Just so many people have been involved on a different level. So it would be hard to really recognize all of those folks. But I think that we have had really an exceptional team. And everyone works wonderfully together. And you may have heard in the background some noise going on because we actually have already started demolishing the current facilities. The former parking garage is coming down. I can see it from my office. And so that just shows you that this team, they are not waiting before they start working on the second phase of the project. And that's going to be the build-out of Concourse A to the east. So the construction is not quite over yet, but the majority of the new SLC project is open, and hopefully passengers will like what they see.
Great. Well, our guest has been Nancy Vollmer. She's with the new Salt Lake City International Airport. Nancy, thanks for all your work. And as you mentioned, there's thousands of people for us to thank for their hard work for giving us this beautiful airport. We've all been hunkering down for 6 or 7 months now. We're all looking forward to seeing it sometime in the near future. Nancy, thanks for joining us. And please stay tuned to Mountain Money. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. STEM Elevated is a STEM interactive learning lab that is a brand new small business to Park City. Joining us this morning to talk about STEM Elevated is Barish Dawson. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm excited to talk to you about this. So perhaps we start at the beginning. How did you become familiar with STEM, and what was your motivation to open STEM Elevated?
Okay, well, I've always been one of those teachers that have believed in hands-on learning. I think it's incredibly important for our kids to learn whilst doing. STEM has been a buzzword in education for going on 10 years now. I actually only learned about it probably 4 years ago, and when I did, I absolutely fell in love with the whole ethos of learning under a kind of a STEM umbrella, if you like. I decided to apply for a job at Jeremy Ranch Elementary. They were piloting a STEM program at that point. And yes, I just kind of jumped in with both feet and fell in love with it. And once I kind of felt that I wanted to take this on my own, I came up along with my husband with the idea of STEM Elevated. And we thought it would be a good idea to start our own business. It's something that Park City doesn't have. We thought it was a good niche to fill. We thought parents would appreciate it. We thought kids would enjoy it. And so that's exactly what we did. We opened up STEM Elevated as a result.
Adno, Barish, this is Doug. I'm so glad to hear that you're doing this. I'm a big fan, obviously, of STEM education. A lot of the audience is also, you know, we're a community that likes to play hard, but we also like to work hard, and we want to see our kids work hard at their studies. One of the things I did with my kids, who are now both in college, was when they were teeny tiny, as soon as they could count, I used to play a game on envelopes at the Einstein Bagels. Here in Park City, we'd go out for a bagel and a hot chocolate, and we'd play a game called Stump the Chump, where there were just silly okay. little math games that All right. we would play. And my kids still talk about that with me, and they talk about it with their friends in college, about how much fun that was with Dad. And I think it developed a love for them of early STEM. And they were like 3 and 5 years old when I would do this. What is the age group that you're targeting, and when should parents start thinking about STEM with their kids?
Goodness, I suppose as soon as they can walk, as soon as they're moving their hands, it's so incredibly important. As you say, it's something that becomes ingrained, and it develops this love of lifelong learning, which is pretty much my sole goal here. My earliest class that I offer is STEM Tots, which is 3 and up. So basically those parents that are looking for opportunities to entertain their kids, as well as, you know, develop fine motor skills, develop a sense of curiosity, etc. Those are on a Wednesday morning, and then we go up from pre-K all the way through to 6th grade. So really, I completely and utterly agree with you. If you are wanting to establish the sense of intrigue with absolutely everything, STEM is the way to go. And learning through games, as you say, is incredibly important in initiating that. So yes, from 3 and up is the earliest that I offer these classes. And I'm slowly but surely building those lessons up. And I'm hoping that over time they're going to gain some popularity, and we'll see some more parents with their little ones soon.
That's wonderful. So STEM Elevated was scheduled to open at the end of March, but unfortunately due to COVID-19, the opening was postponed until this fall. And as you mentioned, you are now offering in-person classes at the facility in Canyon's Corners. You talked about TOTS, but can you just go through the types of classes you offer?
Absolutely. So I offer classes from TOTS all the way up to 6th grade. I essentially band them into age groups, hopefully kind of incorporating similar abilities according to age group. I have pre-K and 1st grade. That's on a Monday afternoon. I have, that was pre-K and kindergarten. I have 1st and 2nd grade on a Tuesday. I have 3rd and 4th on a Wednesday, and 4th and 5th. 5th and 6th on a Thursday. I'm getting everything all mixed up. Yes, we were supposed to open at the end of March. That didn't happen. Not something I can take personally. It is a pandemic after all. A little slow to start, but things are definitely picking up. My classes are now pretty much fully booked, which is incredible. I have a lot of kids carrying over from my first month, so that's always a good sign of confidence that they're actually enjoying what we're doing. And so I'm going up to 6th grade. I am offering the option of 7th graders joining us. I do have a couple of 7th graders that are in my 6th grade class, and they seem to be doing really nicely. It is still a challenge for them. As long as we are challenging our kids and we're kind of broadening their horizons in terms of the way they think, the out-the-box thinking, etc., you know, then they are going to be suited towards a particular age group. But I'm completely flexible. If it's a matter of siblings and, you know, one little one is a little bit nervous to come to a lesson because the older sibling is in that lesson, I will absolutely do my best to accommodate you regardless and meet you where you are.
And I know parents do appreciate that. When you talk about, you know, the groups that have or that were with you from the last month, how do people sign up? Is it a per lesson? Is it a month? Or is there a session length?
So I have two options available. At the beginning of every month, I sell lesson bundles. I bundle those lessons into four. That is slightly cheaper than an individual lesson. My individual lessons are $25 each. My bundles are $90 each. Both you would find on my Book a Class tab on my website. It is very easy to use. It's a matter of just pressing the button, and it will take you through the motions of actually booking the class. Should you have any difficulties at all with that, I encourage you to phone or reach out, and I will do my very best to get back to you as soon as possible.
So I think some of our audience might be surprised. We were talking about my Stump the Chump game earlier with my daughters when they're 3 and 5. They might be surprised that the focus really starts early. And really, the time a lot of people are thinking, oh, I'm going to get my kid into STEM is, you know, when they're 12 or 13. But actually, I think what we're hearing from you is the time to start is early and get that love and then let the kid drive it from there. Is that correct?
Absolutely. All of my younger lessons kind of take on a thematic approach where I will have a themed unit for the month. Each lesson will be kind of focused on a particular book. For instance, there may be a character in the book that's going through a certain challenge. We will then take that challenge and make it our own, where they're creating a solution, thinking about the parameters of that challenge. And yes, you know, the younger the better. You will be so surprised how much these kids are actually able to manage, you know, even at 3 years old. My 3-year-old classes in particular are really kind of fine motor based at the moment, where it's a matter of just kind of learning how to use their hands. As we get older, we start kind of incorporating in more scientific concepts when it comes to a challenge, or engineering concepts when it comes to a challenge. And you just make it fun. You know, they don't actually even realize that they're learning something because they're having so much fun. And I personally feel that that is the best way to learn.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Our guest this morning has been Barish Doshan. She is with STEM Elevated. Barish, thank you for joining us, and please stay tuned to Mountain Money. We'll be back in a minute.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.